Thank you, Karen, and it's certainly very, very nice to spend time with you and Rabbi Rosenfeld as well. And I very much appreciate and I'm honored by the invitation to address you. Obviously, most of the people here are Rabbanim, and some have been Rabbanim longer than me and perhaps have much deeper experience. But as the Mesilas Yesharim writes in his introduction, sometimes the purpose of a talk of Musar and Chizuk is not to teach anybody things that they don't know, but to simply remind and reaffirm basic ideas that are familiar to us, but that we need to hear, we need to internalize, and we need to take out in our work with the Kehillah. You know, I once read that around probably 100 years ago, one of the Orthodox newspapers in Europe was interviewing a bunch of Rabbanim in Lithuania and in Poland as to what they thought was the principal function of a Rav. So the story goes that the Aruch HaShulchan, who is the Rav of Nevardik, said to Paskin Shilas, which of course you'd expect the Aruch HaShulchan to say. Somebody else said to take care of Shechita. And a third person said to establish Chinuch, education in the community. But there is a quote from Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Now, what we know Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, of course, as the Gaon in Lomdus, analytical ability. One surely would have thought that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik would have said the principal goal is to be Machadesh Torah. He said, no. The goal of a Rav is lahatzil oshuk miyad oshko, to save and protect people who are victimized and oppressed from those people that are victimizing them and oppressing. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Gaon in Torah, identified this as the central mission of a Rav b'Yisrael. There are many types of victimizations. People can be victimized, you know, rich against poor. People can be victimized in their jobs, etc. But one particular victimization, which is especially very, very painful, is the victimization of one spouse by another spouse. Whether it culminates in physical abuse, which is kind of the end of the spectrum, or whether there's simply abuse in terms of the derech eretz and the relationship and the anger and the resentments that build up that create a poisonous atmosphere in the home. And here I do have to make an obvious point, and that is not every rabbi is a trained professional. I myself am not a trained professional in abuse cases. And we do have to know, sometimes the greatest chachma is to know when to delegate, when to consult and meet with experts, when to send people, what are the resources in the community. One person cannot take care of everything. Even Moshe Rabbeinu, again, as Mrs. East very correctly noted, Yisro told Moshe, you gotta delegate. And we do have to learn to delegate as well. However, one should also know that it is certainly an abdication of duty to treat issues of abuse and issues of anger management to be solely in the realm of sociology and psychology, and to simply say, well, we just do the religion thing. We answer the shilas of meat and milk, but if there's abuse, if there's anger management, for that we have to send people to the professionals. Because obviously, as Rabbanim and as Mechanchim, we must strive to create a value system and an educational system and a cultural milieu which imparts fundamental values that will prevent a lot of these behaviors from erupting. And if we can nip them in the bud, or if we can create, as it were, preventative strategies, things would be much better. So I'm not going to talk tonight so much about what happens when there's actual physical abuse, because at that point we're very, very late in the intervention process, and there's a whole other series. You have to be concerned with physical security and the like. I'm going to talk about things that are much earlier in the stage. Anger, screaming, fighting, banging on tables. What can we do about that? What should we do about that? Obviously, all of us know the famous Mamori Chazal about Kas, how pernicious anger is. Chazal say, Kol HaKoes, Ki'ilu Oved Avodah Zorah, that anger is considered to be tantamount to the sin of idolatry. There's actually a very beautiful explanation from the Baal HaTanya why anger is equivalent to idolatry. Because if you truly believe that everything that happens in your life was decreed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though people have free will, that's a whole paradox, but nevertheless, whatever happens to a person was nigzar, was decreed by God, then what are you angry at? Are you angry at HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Or maybe you don't believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu decrees what goes on in your life. And therefore the Baal HaTanya says, the very expression of Kas is, as it were, a kafira, a denial of God's intervention in my life, because in a sense what I'm saying is, God is not the actor here, and that is a form of Avodah Zarah. Others learn that Kas is considered to be a form of Avodah Zarah simply because in the moment of rage, you literally lose a consciousness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In the moment of rage, now it may just last for a second, but in that moment of rage, you're willing to do anything. Most of the time we recover before we go further. But in that moment of rage, you lose it. And when you lose that connection to the Tzelem Elokim, the divine soul that is within a person, at that point he has pulled away his connection with Hashem, just like an Oved Avodah Zarah. There is a famous sefer, Rabbi Saul Salanter liked this sefer very much. It was written before Rabbi Saul Salanter, called Cheshbon HaNefesh. And the sefer Cheshbon HaNefesh, which talks about personality developments, in the Hakdama, gives a mashal of what a person is like when he's out of control of his midos. And the mashal he gives is, imagine you're walking by the bank of a river, and you see reeds that are growing straight, and the reeds are unable to move, they can't move, they're rooted to their place. But when the slightest wind comes, they sway to and fro. They can't move on their own, but they are subject to any little gust of wind. And says the Baal Cheshbon HaNefesh, that is the nature of a person who has not worked to develop and refine their midos. Everything coming from the outside will just push them. When their good things happen, they're going to be happy. When bad things happen, they're going to be unhappy. When they're frustrated, they're going to be angry. But that's not really coming from the person, but rather a person who doesn't have that rootedness, who doesn't have that development of midos, that person just sways with the wind. And indeed, we see that often the pattern of even actual abusers often is that they are abusive, and then they might show extreme affection, loving and kind and really good, unusually nice, and then they revert back to that pattern again and again. There is a vort from the Chassam Sofer, I believe, that expresses this very, very beautifully. The vice of being out of control. You remember that Bilam was hired by Balak to curse Bnei Yisrael. And the Gemara says in Brachos that Bilam's great talent was, Bilam knew the exact little fraction of a second every day when there's anger, divine anger in the world. So Bilam knew exactly when to zap him with a curse. So Tosfos and Brachos asks an obvious question, but since that is such a short amount of time, what type of curse could Bilam have said that would have been during that time? So some Mefarshim answer, as long as you begin the curse in the right time, you could finish it even after the time. And some say, since Hashem's midah of generosity is greater than midah sadin, that's a proof that as long as you begin davening Bizman, you could finish tefillah after Zman. Some actually offer that as a defense for Hasidim that davened Shmon Esrei after Zman. Putting that aside, Tosfos's answer is, Bilam could have said a very short curse, a two-syllable curse, the word kalem, kaf, lamed, mem, destroy them. The Chassam Sofer says, kalem is an abbreviation for kaloyos, the kidneys, lave, the heart, the emotions, moach, the brain. The greatest curse a human being could have is when their brain, which is their moral and intellectual faculties, are subordinated to the passions of the moment. Such a person is a bomb, is a time bomb. Such a person is a cannon. Such a person is a danger. Not necessarily a danger in terms of actual violence, that's a separate issue, but in terms of what a person is supposed to become. Bilam is cursing Bnei Yisrael that they should be people whose moach is subordinated to the kaloyos, the passions, and the emotions. What's the opposite of kalem? Melech, a king? The Chasam Sofer says, who is a king? Moach lev kaloyos. The moach, when the mind, which means not just the intellectual, but the intellectual and moral faculty, can control the emotion and direct the emotions in appropriate ways. That before one acts, one weighs and one thinks and one determines what is the appropriate way of acting. In fact, it's said that there were many gedolim who sometimes gave the appearance of being angry. And then immediately afterwards, because they were giving mussar to somebody, they had to be harsh. And immediately afterwards, they went back to their learning as if nothing ever happened. So somebody once asked the Chafetz Chaim, you were so upset a moment ago. How are you able to get back into it? The Chafetz Chaim said, anger to me is like a jacket. I put it on when I need to use it, and then I take it off. You could almost call that fake anger in a way. Sometimes you gotta pretend, but the idea of losing control, that is totally foreign. There is no hasaga at all in the Torah that a person should ever reach a level of anger where they're out of control. Even the anger of the gedolim was always a focused anger, which they could put on and take off immediately. So this is really the idea of melech versus kalem. And here, of course, we really have to go back to what the Balei Musar taught us about Tikkun HaMidos. You know, you may recall that when Rav Yisrael Salanter developed the Musar movements, there was a great deal of controversy. In Volozhin, for example, they didn't want to incorporate the Musar into the curriculum. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik reputedly told Rav Yisrael Salanter, we don't need Musar, we have Gemara, and our Limud HaTorah will make our Talmidim righteous and good people. But Rav Yisrael Salanter remarked that Torah, Limud HaTorah, pure Limud HaTorah, is a wonderful diet for a healthy soul. But when there are sicknesses of the soul, you need special medicines. And the special medicines is to work on our personalities, work on our midos, to strive to become more sensitive, compassionate people. It doesn't come automatically. And indeed, no less of a person than the Vilna Gaon himself says in his commentary to Mishlei a remarkable thing. All of us know that Torah is compared to water. Chazal say, right, many, many psukim, and the Gemara says just like water goes from the high place to the low place, Torah goes from the arrogant to the humble. But the Vilna Gaon gives another reason why Torah is compared to water. If you pour water on ground that has seeds, whatever the seeds are will be facilitated by the water. If there's wheat seeds, you'll get wheat. If there are poisonous weeds, you'll get poisonous weeds. So listen to what the Vilna Gaon says. If a person has good midos, then the Limud HaTorah will make those midos better and better and better. Well, that's pretty obvious. That we would assume is true. But here's the Chiddush. If a person has bad midos, if a person is selfish, if a person is arrogant, if a person is conceited, if a person is rejecting, then the Limud HaTorah itself may actually accentuate and exaggerate and enlarge that sense of arrogance and rejection of others. Because the Koach of Torah is like the Koach of Mayim. Mayim causes a tzmicha, a growth of whatever there is. So certainly I think all of us, both in our own lives and our interactions with others, need to talk about the midos that a human being should have generally, and then specifically the midos that are useful in a marriage. It's very, very clear that if we look at basic values of Torah Judaism, we see how it helps us deal with issues of anger. Let me just give you a quick list, and anyone can make a list of themselves. Obviously, the Torah teaches in many, many places the importance of sensitivity to others, the notion of empathy for the sufferings that other people are going through, feeling their pain, rejoicing in their simchas, as it were. Obviously, if one has developed a sensitivity to the needs of others, the occasions of anger will be few and far between. Let me point out that this sensitivity to others is even inculcated in so-called ritual commandments. You know, there's a story that is told that the Chafetz Chaim, as a young man, was once traveling around selling his Sforim, and he was invited to a house for Shabbos. And when he came home with the Balabayas, the Balabayas noticed that his wife did not cover the Chalos before Kiddush. And the man was embarrassed because he had the Chafetz Chaim there, and he started berating his wife. Why didn't you cover the Chalos? Don't you know we always cover the Chalos before Kiddush? What's going on here? And the Chafetz Chaim stopped the man and said, excuse me, Reb Yid, why is it that we do cover up the Chalos before Kiddush? And there are a few reasons, but the most commonly given reason is we don't want to humiliate the bread, because normally bread is first in place. But for Kiddush, we make hamotzi after wine. The bread will be humiliated. And since the bread will be humiliated, we cover it up so it doesn't make its appearance till after we made Kiddush. So the man knew this. The man said, what do you mean? Of course you cover up the challahs not to embarrass the bread. The Chafetz Chaim said, I see that in your laudable desire to protect the dignity of the bread, it doesn't bother you to degrade the dignity of your wife. Now, this is a simple story, but I think it actually makes a profound point. Because what the Chafetz Chaim is telling you is that bread doesn't really get embarrassed. Some say plants can get embarrassed. You talk to your plants, but certainly even those people, once you cut it, harvest it, and ground it into flour, it's not going to be embarrassed. It's not around anymore. But these are symbolic gestures. They are gestures to inculcate within our personalities respect for the potential humiliation of another person. So if a person learns all of the halachos of covering the bread on Shabbos and doesn't derive a moral lesson there, they're missing the point. They're seeing a bunch of trees and they don't see the overall forest. And if I dare say, with all respect to all of us, that this is actually a hazard that we face in the Frum community, even in our yeshivos, in which we teach pratei pratim of all types of halachos, but we shy away, almost like, you know, well, that's what conservative reform do. They talk about, you know, inner meanings of spirituality. We talk about halacha. But the point is that if we teach halacha divorced from the ethical lessons that halacha teaches, we are making people religious, but we are not making them spiritual. Meaning to say, of course, and of course it's a Dover Pasha, I don't have to say it to the people here, that one cannot have a true kesher with Hashem without shmiras hamitzvos. That's obvious. Obviously, to make your own spirituality isn't going to work. But one has to know that shmiras hamitzvos is the foundation. But on that foundation, you then have to develop avas Hashem, yiras Hashem. The Rambam writes in the Mishnah Torah, every person is mechuyev, even though we never know the ultimate reasons of mitzvos, but the Rambam writes in the Mishnah Torah at the end of Hilchos Temura, that every person is obligated to look at the mitzvos of the Torah for the direction and framework and structure that it gives a person to have ethical consciousness. And therefore, even the Bein Adam Lamakom rituals ultimately have a Bein Adam L'Chaveiro translation. So that's sensitivity to others. A second factor is a Jew is supposed to be grateful for the gift of life. Grateful to Hashem, grateful to other human beings. You know, the Sfas Emes says a wonderful thing. Why are Jews called Yehudim? After all, Yehuda is only one tribe. Says the Sfas Emes, Leah called her fourth child Yehuda because she said, Hapam Odes Hashem, now I am grateful to God. And why was she grateful? Because she knew that there would be 12 Shvatim and there are four wives. So 12 divided by four, each wife should get three. So the first three is Kumtmir. The first three she wasn't grateful because that's her chalik. When she gets more than she deserves, that's when we have gratitude. Zuck the Sfas Emes. Every Jew must go through life with the idea, Hashem has given me more brachos than I deserve. And that's why we're called Yehudim, because hapam odes Hashem. Gratitude and appreciation. Hakoras hatov. The story is told, Rav Victor Miller, of course, Rav Victor Miller, was one of his great themes throughout his whole life. was to stress the importance of gratitude. Based on the Chovos HaLevavos in the Shar HaBechina, Rabbi Avigdor Miller, in one of his early books, I think Rejoice, O Youth, has around a 20-page description of what you think about when you eat a banana. I can't duplicate it, but he talks about the texture, the color, the smell, all of the things that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did. Really, it's based on the Chovos HaLevavos, although there's Hakara Satov. The story goes that his granddaughter once came home and found him with his head submerged in the kitchen sink. So she was horrified. She went and she dragged him off. And he said, don't worry, I would have gotten up in a second anyway. She said, Zadie, why was your head in the kitchen sink? So he said, I'll tell you the problem. I was walking with somebody in Flatbush, and somebody said to me, gee, the air is very polluted today. And I noticed it seemed polluted, and that took away some of the gratitude that I normally feel for breathing. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to put my head in an atmosphere where I couldn't breathe at all, put my head under the water, so that when I lift up my head after 10 seconds, I say, you know, the air isn't so bad. Hakara Satov. Once again, so much anger, so much abuse. Again, I'm not referring to the ultimate pathological abuse physically, but I'm talking about the abuse that can arise even in good marriages or in troubled marriages as well. Comes from a sense of frustration, from a sense that my needs are not being met, from a sense that I'm not getting what I want out of life. But if a person could understand that good enough is good enough. If a person understands, Baruch Hashem, I can walk, I can talk, I can breathe. I have a roof over my house. I don't have to live on bread and water. Notalti yeser al chelki. So that itself helps us tremendously in dealing with frustration. Because we have so many, again, most, the overwhelming majority of people around here have so many brachos beyond that which is needed for bare minimal survival. So that's a second factor to stress the midah of hakaras hatov. That's why there's brachos on food, and that's why there's brachos for every occasion. Going to the bathroom, it's interesting, I read an article recently by a urologist, who said that, you know, he was a yeshiva boy, and they always made fun of the fact, oh, you make a bracha and you go to the bathroom. But as a urologist, he saw why you make a bracha when you go to the bathroom, to be even grateful for those little, so-called little things, what a chesed it is. A third factor that is so necessary to deal with this issue of anger, and many have said this is the single greatest gift we can give our children, is resilience in the face of adversity and disappointments. Life is often very tough. Right, the old question of theodicy: why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good things happen to bad people? That's asked a little less often, but that's also a question. Sometimes, God forbid, the adversities are very serious. They might be serious illness. They might be death. They might be suffering. Other times, the frustrations might be, you know, someone didn't make a basketball team they wanted to become part of. They didn't get into medical school. I mean, there are issues which are big for somebody, but maybe in the cosmic scheme, they're not so big. And as Viktor Frankl once remarked in his really immortal book, Man's Search for Meaning, to a large degree, we don't have control over what happens to us. Hashem decrees it, whatever it is, we just don't have control over it. But the one thing we have control over is how we respond to the difficulties that are put into our life. Without giving explanations, that's a talk for another time. And Viktor Frankl called that the last freedom. We could choose to take the difficulties of life and respond to them in a noble, compassionate, and growing way. Or we can use it to become embittered and hateful. That's our choice. We can reframe the picture to look any different way, right? If you put a different frame on a picture, the picture looks totally different. Every human being can reframe. This quality of resilience, many psychologists have said, if they could package this quality of resilience, how come, you know, so many kids in the inner city ghettos become criminals and drug addicts? And then you have a Dr. Benjamin Carson, the head of neurosurgery in Johns Hopkins, who is a black from the inner city of Detroit, who grew up in that ghetto, who was part of a gang, who was involved in selling drugs, what gave him that ability? If we knew that, we'd get the Nobel Prize. It certainly, we would know how to deal with kids at risk. We would know how to do everything. We don't know the secret. But certainly, one of the great qualities that we can give our children, if we try to get it ourselves, is this quality of resilience in the face of adversity. Because this gives a person the strength and the courage to deal with frustrations when they recognize that all of these so-called frustrations and disappointments are challenges that can make us bigger and better. Even if we have difficult interactions with people, maybe even our spouses, we can actually say, as Miriam Adahan writes, Baruch Hashem that I have the opportunity to work on my midos. If I had a person with whom I always agreed, with whom I never fought, with whom there was nothing that was done that was ever upsetting, I would be like a vegetable. I wouldn't be challenged. I wouldn't grow. And you can look at it as a pride, a prideful, and one is allowed to have a certain amount of pride in working on their midos. I don't know if it works for working on anava, but certainly other midos, one should feel a sense of accomplishment, a victory of sorts, that I had this difficult trial, and I passed it. I surmounted it. That's why it says by King Yehoshaphat, Vayigba libo b'darchei Hashem. There's a certain confidence that one gets with spiritual victories, because it is a victory. Umoshel Barucho Miloche Dir, Shlomo HaMelech says, he who can control his spirit is more heroic than he who conquers a city. So that is that quality of resilience in the face of adversity. Again, I mean, I just mentioned a person that I often used as an example, who was not even Jewish. He just died recently. Christopher Reeve was actually a very, very outstanding example, a non-Jew, but who took the tragedy of his life and used it to give people encouragement and inspiration. That at one point he indeed said he wanted to kill himself. He couldn't even kill himself. He wanted his wife to pull out his plug because he was paralyzed. But after that night, he decided that whatever happened to him, there's a reason, there's a purpose, and he's going to make something good out of his life. And that's a tremendous inspiration, I think, for all of us. And a final basic value is, which is really connected to all of these things, is to have a sense of ultimate purpose. And that's what Frumkeit is. What is keeping mitzvos? Keeping mitzvos is not just about a bunch of things I got to do every day. But it's about seeing an overall purpose in your life. That the purpose of our lives are to be Ovdei Hashem, to do Hashem's will, to bring Kedusha in the world. And if a person always asks themselves, is what I'm doing furthering that end, or is what I'm doing taking me away from that end? As the Rambam writes in the Shmoneh Perakim, one lives a life of purposeful, conscious commitment. Then one can develop, it's very difficult, but one can at least begin to develop the self-control that helps a person deal with anger. But there is something positive about anger. And the positive feature about anger, and this was pointed out by Rav Zelig Pliskin, is his book on anger, it's a very nice book, is called Anger, the Hidden Teacher. He says anger can be a tremendous tool. Again, not expressing it, but in other words, if we think about our anger, we can identify triggers. We can identify events. And by reconstructing the scenarios that make us feel this upsurge of anger, resentment, or fury, we get to understand what makes us tick, how we work. And by going through that process of analysis, by knowing exactly where the pressure point is, some people get angry because they feel the other person doesn't understand them. Some people get angry because they're frustrated at their inability to express their own needs. Some people are angry because they feel powerless and rootless and unconnected, and out of their impotence turns into a self-loathing. And since it's very hard to loathe yourself, it then manifests itself in attacking often those who are nearest and dearest. So anger is a complicated phenomenon. When a person gets angry because supper was late, or when a person got angry because a cup of juice spilled on their jacket, that's not why they're angry. They're angry because of some generalization that is taking place in their mind. She doesn't respect me. She doesn't care about me. That is why she was careless, or whatever it might be. So Rav Zelig Plissken suggests, as a preliminary Musar exercise, that we should try to identify, write down in a book, what is it that makes me angry? Is it because I feel unloved? Is it because I feel rejected? Is it because people don't respect me? Is it because I don't like myself? And by creating that type of diary, you can, as it were, almost float above yourself. In fact, the term that's often used is floating above it, in which you can look at yourself the way a third party could look at you, and then you could analyze, as it were, what makes you tick. In fact, sometimes I know myself that when rabbis have problems, whatever our problems might be, so sometimes the necessary thing to do is, okay, what would you tell somebody else who came to you with this problem? Because, as it were, when we're dealing with our own issues, our judgment is colored, but we try to get outside of ourselves, and then perhaps we're able to see the situation objectively. Derech Agav, there's a beautiful story about the Shach. The great Shach once had a din Torah against somebody. And the Shach went in front of a Beis Din. And the Shach argued and argued his position. And the Beis Din decided against the Shach. And why did they decide against the Shach? So the Dayan said, you know, all of the svaras you were arguing were wonderful, but we came across this new sefer printed on Choshen Mishpat, which was the Shach's commentary, and he refutes all of your arguments. In other words, the Shach himself, as a Lamdin, came to another conclusion. But when it came to his own agenda, he saw things the other way. Hashochad yaver einei chachamim. And therefore, the idea of floating above and analyzing is a helpful technique. I remember reading once that the Telzer Rav, was once walking in the street. He was having a cane. And he remarked to a student in passing, you know, I feel like taking this cane and smashing that vase right now. Now, obviously, he wasn't going to do it. But he was so attuned to him, to himself, that he sensed when there was a tension, when there was a constriction. He analyzed every single function, every single thought. And that leads very much to self-mastery. So these are things that we need. I should also mention the notion of game playing. Game playing is game playing, but it is significant. Rav Dessler has a beautiful essay on the concept of the So'ir HaMishtaleach, right? We had Yom Kippur recently, and the mysterious ritual of the scapegoat, which has entered the English language. So the Ramban quotes the Zohar that says the So'ir HaMishtaleach is a shochad, it is a bribe that you give the satan. Because when you want to approach the king, there are sometimes pit bulls that attack you. So a good robber carries some beefsteak. So when the dogs attack him, he throws him the steak, and then he goes into the melech. So too, the Ramban says, when we want to approach HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there are kochos of tuma, powers of impurity that prevent us. So we give him a korban, give him a goat, and get him out of the way. Now the truth is, the Ramban's explanation, this is even more difficult than the original meaning of the mitzvah. A shochad l'satan, you're bribing the satan? So Rav Dessler offers what you might call a psychological, ethical interpretation of what is certainly a very mystical idea. And that is, in life, we have to bribe the Yetzer Hara by doing things that seem to be concessions, because that way the Yetzer Hara has less force over us. An example, let's assume you decided, even outside of Torah, you decided you didn't want to eat chocolate anymore for health and weight reasons. So you get up and you say, I will never eat another bar of chocolate the rest of my life. Well, what's going to happen is, the moment after you make that sentence, the first thought that will be in your mind is, I mean, the rest of my life? You mean, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, Ad Me'a V'Yesrim? I can't do that. And then you'll run to the refrigerator or to the store and buy a lot of chocolate. Because what happens is, when you try to destroy the Yetzer Hara, the enemy fights back with ferocity. So what you have to do is, you have to play games. You have to say, it's 2 o'clock now, I don't have to have chocolate till 2:30, I can wait a half an hour. The Yetzer Hara leaves you alone because a half an hour, no, it'll get you later. But what the Yetzer Hara doesn't know, and again, I'm anthropomorphizing this, I'm just speaking in a metaphor here. The Yetzer Hara doesn't know that there's such a thing called mitzvah gareres mitzvah, that your strength at 2:30 is stronger than it was at 2 o'clock. So Rav Dessler says, this is the shochad l'satan. When a person says, I'll never speak Lashon Hara again, he will be seized with an uncontrollable desire to speak Lashon Hara. But if a person says, you know, I can wait to gossip until 2:30 in the afternoon, he can do that. And then at 2:30, you know, well, okay, I can wait a little longer. So it's game playing. And by anger, we have all sorts of psychological games. Count to 10. Walk around the block. The altar of Kelim had a red coat, a red kapata, that hung in his closet that was called his anger jacket. And he had a Kabbalah. He would never get angry till he went to the closets and put on his red coat. Now, the nature of anger is, you can even track it, probably even biologically, by kind of the rise in adrenaline and like, there is really a relatively short critical mass period. And if you can get over that hump successfully, you're going to be able to navigate it. Right? Now, I'm not saying this solves all the resentments and tensions that need to be addressed, but then they could be addressed as a discussion as opposed to the theory of the anger. So game playing is an important role in Avodas Hashem. I don't mean to trivialize that idea. And of course, as all of us know, when we talk about the tshuva process and we try to do tshuva ourselves, you have to adopt small, incremental, realistic goals and stick with them, as opposed to global, tremendous goals, which are very hard to keep. And then the Yetzer Hara fights back, and then you don't do anything. What was the story? They say Leo Tolstoy, besides being a great novelist, was a social reformer. He wrote tracts calling for the abolition of serfdom in 19th century Russia. So somebody said to him once, Count Tolstoy, you know, you're against slavery, but you treat your own serfs pretty badly. So Tolstoy's response was, just because I'm a lover of humanity doesn't mean I have to care about people. The concept was, he loved abstractions. He loved globalization. But the here and now didn't matter so much. Yiddishkeit is exactly the opposite. Abstractions, okay. You can come to abstractions, but you come to abstractions by living a life of the here and now. The ahavta l'reicha kamocha is not just caring about the chesed that is done for Klal Yisrael in the broadest sense, although it includes that. But it starts with the chesed that we show our wives and our children and our husbands. And Yisrael Salanter said, L'reyecha, your dearest friend, Sameach Tesamach, Reyim Ahuvim. Right? Husband and wife are called beloved Reyim, beloved friends. And that is specifically where one must focus on the idea of the Ahavta L'reyecha Kamocha. And finally, as I indicated before, one must take pride in these accomplishments. One needs to understand that controlling anger and learning to see people l'kaf sechus and learning to be compassionate, even if it's not easy, one should be proud because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is proud. The Chovas HaLevavos writes that there is nothing in Ruchnius that is too small that Hashem doesn't cherish it and treasure it. Every small victory is so significant. And even when a person later fails, he shouldn't think that that negates the victory that he's accomplished and therefore throw it all away. Rather, as the Pasuk says, a tzaddik can fall many times, but gets up again. And so too, when we fail in showing anger, sometimes that leads to us hating ourselves even more. And of course, that's the vicious cycle in which self-loathing can actually perpetuate more anger directed towards the person that caused us to hate ourselves because we got angry. But you can break that cycle. And every day is a new opportunity. And every day, Hashem gives us a new chance. The Mefarshim say, when we say Moda Ani every morning, we say Bechemla Rabba Emunasecha with great, or Bechemla, comma, Rabba Emunasecha, your Emuna is great, your faith is great. So some Mefarshim say, the faith that Hashem has in us is very great. That even if we think we can't do it, Hashem gives us life every day because He has faith that we can rise to those challenges. And this is, I think, something that we need to talk about. We need to model, to the extent, again, I'm not at all holding myself up as a model. I mean, obviously, this whatever Musr there is Musr to me. But we need to talk this language. We need to model this language. We need to encourage people with pats on the back who are trying to work on their midos, even if mistakes are occasionally made. And I should also say as well that we also need to communicate more clearly, even in the high school level, what marriage is about. So now I'm moving perhaps a little bit away from anger in the abstract to talking about the idea of marriage. I once read a survey, and I cannot believe this because it is so ludicrous to almost sound like a joke, like a Saturday Night Live parody of something, in which boys in some yeshiva were asked what they saw is the purpose of marriage. And they said, to find a person who will do whatever I want. This was the majority response. Again, it's honestly hard for me to believe, but apparently, at least in some circles, this is a message that's being absorbed. Let me share with you a thought of the Tor, the great Tor. The Pasuk says, Lo tov heyo sa'adam levado. It is not good for man to be alone. Eselo ezer kenegdo. Let us make a helpmate to be opposite him. So the Tor asks the Kasha, why isn't it good? Remember, Adam is in Gan Eden. He could have whatever he wants. He doesn't need someone to clean his clothes, right? At that point, he wasn't wearing clothes. What is not good about being alone? And the Tor says the following insights. When man is alone in the Garden of Eden, he has an infinite capacity to take whatever he wants. But there is no one to whom he can give. And if a human being is in the image of God, and God's essence is one of giving, because there's nothing that God can take, He has everything. I can be a godly person only if I learn to emulate the divine quality of giving. And therefore, the way the Torah translates the Pasuk doesn't mean it is not good for man to be alone, but rather, man that is alone is a lo tov. Hashem is tov. Man alone cannot be a tov. To paraphrase John F. Kennedy, ask not what your marriage can do for you. You ask what you can do for your marriage. Marriage was ordained by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to teach us, husbands and wives, to care about another, to try to be selfless, to escape our egos, to learn to reach out to somebody else, and in that way we open our hearts to receive the Shekhinah. And if one visualizes marriage as the character builder, and of course parenthood even more so, parenthood is the next stage. If one looks at this as, this is Hashem's gift to me to make me a better person, then as Miriam Adahan says, the frustrations are part of the gift. The frustrations are part of the test. They are what Hashem is putting in your life to bring out these wonderful midos. Right? So that's the idea. That's what the Torah says. In fact, this is what the Mefarshim say. You know, we say at a bris, Kishem shenichnis lebris, ken yikanes l'tayra l'chupa l'masim tovim. Now, the Mefarshim asked the Kasha, it's not in chronological sequence. Torah, okay, as soon as the child learns how to talk, he should say Torah. But chuppah is 18. Even Pirkei Avos says only 18. We get married later. Masim Tovim seems to be bar mitzvah. So it shouldn't say Torah, chuppah, masim tovim. It should say Torah, masim tovim, chuppah. The Baalei Musar say that the meaning of masim tovim does not refer to mitzvos. Mitzvos, indeed, is before chuppah. Mitzvos are from the time you're bar mitzvah. But it's going back to the pasuk of lo tov heyos adam levado. There are many decisions in life which are neither mitzvos nor averos. If I ask a Rav, should I buy a box of Cheerios or a box of Corn Flakes? The Rav's answer, I assume, is going to be, if they're both kosher, you can do what you want. I really have no opinion. I like Cheerios more, but you know, you may have a different view about that. So there are many issues. What type of car I have, what type of furniture I have in my house, which are not issues of Avodas Hashem necessarily. But you get married, and let's assume your wife likes Cheerios and you like cornflakes, and you go shopping and you have to make a decision, what cereal will I get? Or will I get both of them? What has happened is an amazing transformation. Mundane concerns, which previously had no spiritual significance, can now become opportunities for chesed and giving. And that's Masim Tovim. When is every single thing Masim Tovim? That's after the chuppah. Because the whole purpose is to make me a tov, make me and my spouse a tov, to counteract the low tov, heyos ha'adam levada. Once again, if one has the Torah's insight in their minds, that itself is a great, great key to deal with many of the frustrations we experience in married life. Let me mention another insight from the Sifrei Chassidus. Sfas Emes says it, many others for him. Let's look at the end of the pasuk. Let me make an ezer, a helpmate, kenegdo, to be opposite him. So the Gemara in Yavama says, well, what is it? Is your wife a helpmate, or is your wife an opposite, opposition? So the Gemara gives a pragmatic answer. Well, if you're lucky, you'll get ezer. If you're not lucky, you'll get a kenegdo. But in the Sifrei Chassidus, they say a very sharp insight. They say the true ezer of marriage is the loving and loyal opposition. Meaning, marriage should not be, I marry my clone, although there's no such thing as a same-sex, there's a different-sex clone. But the point is, it is precisely the fact that husband and wife see life in different ways that allows each person, the kenegdo, that allows each person to become a greater person than they would have been alone. So instead of being frustrated because the other doesn't see things my way, that's exactly the point, the Azer Connecto. The loyal and loving. Now again, that's not to say that, you know, everything should be a point of machlokas. Part of life is that there should be somebody, when you've had a bad day, whether in the house or outside of the house, where somebody pats you on the back and says, you're doing fine. There's a little toy you can get at airports for beleaguered middle executives. That says, you're great, you have wonderful ideas, you know. And the truth of the matter is, a human being needs that, and that is one of the things that husbands and wives should give to each other. But that's not all they should give to each other. When criticism is warranted, in a loving way, very, very important, then when something could be looked at in a different way, instead of getting angry, that should be the Azer Connecto. That expands my horizons. Just like Avraham that represents chesed, married a Sarah that was more strict, as it were, the Gevura, and Yitzchak that represents strict din, married a Rivka. And what happened was that Avraham became stronger by his interaction with Sarah, and Sarah became more chesed with her interaction with Avraham. Each one incorporates, of course you have to be careful, there's an old joke with George Bernard Shaw, and Isadora Duncan, who was a famous dancer, that they were sitting at a party, and Isadora Duncan said to George Bernard Shaw, Mr. Shaw, if we would get married, we would have children with my looks and your brains, we would have wonderful children. So Shaw is said to have remarked, yes, but what if they have my looks and your brains, then we're in trouble. So you have to be careful when we talk about incorporating, chas v'shalom, we don't mean to incorporate, each one incorporates the bad midas of the other. That's not too much of a game. But each one incorporates the good of each other, you become better and stronger. So I think if we remember the Azer Kenegdo argument. So two things. This one pasuk has two ideas. It is not good for man to be alone. I am here to be a giver. And I grow by creative tension. That itself can help me over the long haul. I know it's running late. I just want to just end with two very, very short stories. And then I will stop. In Eastern Europe, they used to keep records of Meissen in the Pincus, right? There's the Pincus of Lublin and Brisk and the like. So this is a story that is recorded in the Pincus of Lublin from the time of the Marshal, Rav Shlomo Luria, which goes back to the 1500s. And there are two short stories. Story number one, a woman was on her deathbed and she was a jealous type. And she made her husband swear that he would never marry again. And, you know, his wife was dying, so he swore he would never marry again. A year later, he was lonely, and somebody wanted to marry him. So he went to the marshal, and he asked the shaila, is my oath binding since it's keneged a mitzvah? The marshal researched the matter, and the marshal paskened, you can marry. He married his second wife, and he died a week later. So the second wife came to the marshal and said, you killed my husband! Because obviously Hashem punished him because he violated the oath. Do something about it. So the marshal researched the shaila again. He ordered the person's coffin to be opened. He dropped his tshuva into the coffin. And apparently it was decided that the Malach HaMavis made a mistake. And it is recorded there was techiyas ha-mason. It was a mistake. Again, I cannot explain exactly how those mistakes occur, but there was a mistake. Okay. Some people are never satisfied. The woman wasn't happy. She went to the marshal and said, I'm not happy because I feel like I'm living with a dead man. I just, you know, it's just not the same. Do something about it. Pray that I should forget that he ever died or that I should feel about him the same way. And the marshal prayed, and indeed her feelings were as strong as they were before. These are the two stories. There is a footnote at the story that the Chachmei Lublin said the second story is a greater miracle than the first story. Because the first story is resurrection of the dead. And the second story is a changing of the hearts. And it is a greater miracle to change the human heart than it even is to revive the dead. It looks like an impossible task, but here is the mamish, the finest final story. They tell the story. It's kind of an update of the Dubner Magid of a king that constructed a tower of 1,000 stories, and he said, as kings always say, "Whoever climbs to the top of this tower gets to marry my daughter." I don't know if the daughter was consulted in these stories, but this was the story. Most people didn't bother. 1,000 stories, hayitochen. But one fellow said, listen, I'll do what I can. 10 stories, okay. 20 stories, already puffing. I would be puffing well before that. 25 stories, he's getting really tired. People are laughing at him. Oh, just another 975 stories and you'll make it. He keeps on going, 30, 40. By 50, he is on the verge of collapse. He goes to 55. He collapses on the landing. The 55th floor turns into an express elevator and takes him to the top. And the Bali Musar that use this mashal and use this story say that is what Tikkun HaMidos and really the whole tshuva process is about. We look at the type of person we would like to become and it looks like it's totally impossible. How could I become that person? That's not me. And yet we have to recognize we can't climb that 1,000-story tower, but we can do a little bit. And then we have to remember, Abal the Tahir, you try to do a little bit, Hashem opens the gates. But if you never try, if you don't make that move, no gates are open. The Chiddush Yerim says, that's the message of Pesach Sheni. What's Pesach Sheni? A bunch of Tamei people came to Moshe and said, why should we lose the chance of bringing the Korban Pesach? And Moshe asked Hashem, and Hashem said, all right, they can come a month later. The Chiddush Yerim says, what if they wouldn't have asked? There wouldn't have been. If you don't ask, Hashem doesn't open the doors. But when you ask and you want, then all sorts of doors are going to be open. Pischuli kepesach shel machatz, open for me the eye of a needle, and I will open up, Hashem says, like the gates of the Beis HaMikdash. As I say, when we are dealing with extreme pathologies at the one end of the spectrum, that's really a different talk. But what I'm dealing with tonight are the more basic fundamental issues of midos, of derech eretz, of working on oneself, of understanding that being a religious Jew is not just a matter of rituals, but it's a matter of personality development and growth. And that these lessons need to be taught to a chassan and a kala, and they need to be taught to kids in high school and kids in yeshiva to understand how to respect women in particular, although I'm not saying this is only a man problem, but certainly there's an issue of how to respect women and treat women decently is very, very important here. And these are things that we need to talk about, and we need to root them in Torah Makoros as well. So it's not just rabbi as psychologist or rabbi as social worker, but it's rabbi as one who is trying to communicate the teachings of HaKadosh Baruch Hu as interpreted by Chazal and our Gedolim over the centuries. Again, I wish for all of you much hatzlacha in your avodas HaKodesh, and may all of us be zocha that these problems should disappear and maybe we'll be put out of work. And then we can go back to the shiurim and chidushei Torah and the other much more pleasant functions. But as long as we do live in this world, it's necessary that we do what we can. Lahatzil oshuk miyad oshka. Thank you.